The following was written by Rory Verratto and published on February 14th, 2018 on Critical Theory Research Network. The title, We Are the Threat, Reflections on Near-Term Human Extinction. Begins with two quotes, the first from H.P. Lovecraft and the second from Aldo Leopold. H.P. Lovecraft writes, The most merciful thing in the world, I think, is the inability of the human mind to correlate all its contents. We live on a placid island of ignorance in the midst of black seas of infinity, and it was not meant that we should voyage far. The sciences, each straining in its own direction, have hitherto harmed us little, but someday the piecing together of dissociated knowledge will open up such terrifying vistas of reality, and of our frightful position therein, that we shall either go mad from the revelation or flee from the deadly light into the peace and safety of a new dark age. Aldo Leopold, One of the penalties of an ecological education is that one lives alone in a world of wounds. Section 1. Content Warning. Mortality Salience and Eruptions of Extinction Awareness. This essay explores an unsettling topic, the probability of near-term human extinction. Before I continue with this exploration, let me issue two caveats. First, in writing this essay, I am thinking through, grappling with, and attempting to synthesize an enormous and diverse volume of information. This is an important exercise for me as I prepare to embark on writing a dissertation informed by this content. So although I have full confidence in the analysis and theorizing that follows, this essay is an incipient, if not a final, representation of my thoughts on this issue. Despite my thinking's nascent state, I am sharing this essay because, given what I take to be the urgency of this matter, I want to offer something like a preview and a guide for those readers who wish to pursue their own independent research regarding this topic. This leads me to the second caveat. I want to emphasize in the strongest possible terms that the reader should carefully consider the gravity of joining me on this journey. If you are in a fragile state of mind, or if you wish not to enter into a fragile state of mind, you might want to stop reading now. This is a sincere warning. What follows not only has the potential to induce existential crisis, but I am intentionally presenting it for the express purpose of inducing existential crisis. Caveat lector. Still here? Very well then. Let me begin with a concrete example that, I argue, is representative of the kind of awareness that will soon begin imposing itself more and more frequently on more and more persons. Last month in Hawaii, there was a ballistic missile alert issued via cell phone by the emergency alert system. The warning appeared on smartphone screens everywhere as follows. Emergency alert. Ballistic missile threat inbound to Hawaii. Seek immediate shelter. This is not a drill. Now, as it turned out, there was no ballistic missiles inbound for Hawaii. Nevertheless, the emergency alert was not retracted until 38 minutes after it had been issued. Following this event, both the initial alarm and the delayed retraction were explained away by state officials as having resulted from simple human error. That explanation is comically unconvincing, to be sure. But speculating about what might lie ahead or what might lie behind it is not within the purview of this essay. All that matters for our purposes is that this event did occur. What this warning produced for 38 minutes in the people of Hawaii can be described as mass panic. But more specifically, this panic, which drove at least one family to hide their children in a sewer, was a simultaneous and widespread manifestation of mortality salience, or heightened self-conscious recognition that death is inevitable. The experience of mortality salience is a uniquely and fundamentally human phenomenon because, quote, since we humans are aware that we exist, we also know that someday we will not exist, unquote. For more than half an hour, Hawaiians thought that someday was right now. Editor's note that he's going to have hot links throughout this. I'm not going to bother trying to cite what those hot links are. That particular one I will mention was Sheldon Solomon. This event is of critical importance because normally, as anthropologist Ernest Becker's pathbreaking work on death denial shows, thoughts about our own mortality are screened out of our conscious awareness. Inspired by Becker's insight, social psychologist Sheldon Solomon and others have developed terror management theory, which posits that the typical human response to mortality salience, or death reminders, is defensive in nature. That is, in the face of death, humans will draw upon their shared cultural resources, religious, philosophical, ideological, etc., and their personal sense of self-esteem to manage their terror by convincing themselves of their literal and or symbolic immortality. In other words, to shield ourselves from, quote, the uniquely human fear of inevitable death, unquote. We convince ourselves that we are significant contributors to a permanent world. We will live on, we assure ourselves, through any combination of our accomplishments, our children, the collective continuation of our society, reincarnation, ascension into heaven, and innumerable other supposed sources of literal or symbolic immortality. Indeed, most human activities, both personal and cultural, are at their roots undertaken in pursuit of such immortality projects. Each of us vaingloriously thinks of himself or herself as miniaturized Ozymandiases or Cleopatra. So even though everyone's got a bomb, quote-unquote, and we could all die any day as the doomsday clock of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, a non-agenarian former Secretary of Defense, and the 2017 Nobel Prize recipients are desperately trying to remind us, we pacify ourselves with delusions of immortality. But these rationalizations tend to successfully assuage humans' fears of death only in the absence of looming danger. Indeed, it's fairly easy to be comforted by beliefs in one's literal or symbolic immortality when one is relatively safe and healthy. But it's comparatively difficult to talk yourselves out of acknowledging your mortality when the cold hand of death grips your shoulder. When, for example, you are told by a credible source that a ballistic missile is about to annihilate the entire island on which you are inescapably standing. So the Hawaiian missile scare, I want to say, is representative of a new class of phenomenon that are becoming increasingly prevalent in our world, eruptions of extinction awareness. In provoking extremely high levels of mortality salience in those affected by these eruptions or intrusions into conscious awareness, these events will bore like termites through the various defenses described above until wholesale failure of those defenses occurs. As a result, death terror will become unmanageable and panic will ensue. Importantly, these events need not actually come to pass. The ballistic missiles need not detonate nor even be launched to produce these effects. All that matters is that these events are perceived as being imminently probable. Thanks mainly to the rapid, instantaneous dissemination of the alert from an authoritative and consensus-generating source, coupled with the background fear of nuclear war stemming from the escalating tensions between the unstable leaders of the United States and North Korea, the Hawaiian missile scare produced just this result, i.e. the terror of death in those subjected to it. Indeed, if this example strikes in your heart as an unpleasantly familiar pang, it's probably because you have already experienced such an event at least once before. The attacks on September 11, 2001, erupted in millions of people precisely the same kind of terror. So much terror, in fact, that the American government lied its way into a never-ending war on it. Now, even if we accept my cursory description of the phenomenology of these events, why do I make the strong and perhaps outrageous seeming claim that they are indicators of near-term? Here we must make recourse to and then build backwards from an application of first principles, particularly principles of ecology. In other words, we must come to see how fundamental ecological principles operating on the global human population render near-term human extinction an ecological, or even a thermodynamic, certainty. Okay, I'm going to read that again. Now, even if we accept my cursory description of the phenomenology of these events, why do I make the strong and perhaps outrageous seeming claim that they are indicators of near-term human extinction? Here we must make recourse to, and then build backwards from, an application of first principles, particularly principles of ecology. In other words, we must come to see how fundamental ecological principles operating on the global human population render near-term human extinction an ecological or even a thermodynamic certainty. Once this truth is grasped, it becomes obvious that although the particular instantiations of these eruptions can and will vary, sometimes chaotically, consider the recently popularized black swan theory, their general appearance as antecedents to a foregone conclusion, extinction, is as definite as a pressure drop heralding the onset of a storm. Put differently, the specific ways in which these eruptions will arrive are more or less undetermined, but that they will arrive is certain. Therefore, as a class of phenomena, events that produce eruptions of extinction awareness ought to be thought of as portents, omens, foreshadows, or harbingers of extinction. By learning to read and prognosticate about these signs, we can come to see, as the people of Kiribati already have, that we are living through a chronicle of an extinction foretold. Before continuing, let me qualify a bit of what I've just said. By near term, I mean quite possibly within my lifetime. I'm 29 years old. And even more probably within the 21st century in general. By extinction, I mean to evoke the simplest sense of that word, complete disappearance of humans from existence. But more accurately, I mean something like sudden drastic reduction or even total eradication of human population concomitant with the collapse of complex advanced industrial society. I mean ecological in the standard, if rarely truly applied to humans, sense of the word. And I mentioned thermodynamics because of the centrality of energy, specifically fossil fuels, to the causality of near-term human extinction. Finally, I ask the intrepid reader to open his or her mind and, at the risk of becoming unmoored, receive what follows with maximal charity. What I am about to discuss will likely challenge many of your core beliefs and assumptions about yourself and the world. These notions will have to be washed away, for in the words of Murray Bookchin, quote, "The assumption that what currently exists must necessarily exist is the acid that corrodes all visionary thinking." The assumption that what currently exists must necessarily exist is the acid that corrodes all visionary thinking, Murray Bookchin. And contemplating death or extinction is about as visionary as thinking gets. Related, keep in mind Walter Benjamin's haunting description of how, just as we humans witness history in hindsight as a chain of events piling wreckage upon wreckage, so too we are irresistibly propelled into the future to which our backs are turned. So again, he's saying, keep in mind Walter Benjamin's haunting description of how, just as we humans witness history in hindsight as a, quote, chain of events piling wreckage upon wreckage, unquote, so too are we irresistibly propelled, quote, into the future to which our backs are turned, unquote. In other words, we contemporary humans normally relate to time not that much differently than did the ancient Greeks, who experienced the future as something that came upon them from behind their backs, with the past receding away before their eyes. I'm going to read that again because that's good. So basically, he's saying that we contemporary humans normally relate to time not that much differently than did the ancient Greeks, who experienced the future as something that came upon them from behind their backs, with the past receding away before them, before their eyes. Our lot, it seems, is perpetually to take ourselves by surprise. However, we humans also have tremendous powers of foresight. Indeed, foresight is the complement to memory. For as psychologist Donna Atis and her colleagues have shown, there are in humans, quote, striking similarities between remembering the past and imagining or simulating the future, including a common brain network that underlies both memory and imagination, unquote. In other words, many of the same brain regions are commonly engaged by past and future event construction. This should not surprise anyone who has ever dreamed. Thus, one way that we can use our powers of foresight, as Jürgen Habermas said, is to try to imagine our current situation as the past present for a future historian. So again, he's saying that one way we can use our powers of foresight, as Habermas has said, is, quote, to try to imagine our current situation as the past present for a future historian. In this way and others, we can glance over our shoulders at the future that lies behind and yet ahead of us. Indeed, this is how some perspicacious observers like Michael Moore, and yes, me, and that's hotlinked, were able to predict with clarity the election of American fascist Donald Trump. But importantly, all humans do and can have access to this power of perception, for we are human, nothing human is alien to us. So please, remain humble about what you may think you know, and become comfortable with the possibility that you may be capable of knowing more than you think. Section 2. The Case. Population Overshoot. With that ground clearing complete, and in the interests of time and space, let me summarize and comment on what I take to be the most clear-eyed account of humans' precarious position in the world. I am referring to sociologist William R. Catton Jr.'s convincing claim in his astounding 1980 book Overshoot, The Ecological Basis of Revolutionary Change, that misuse of fossil fuels has enabled the human population to overshoot, that is, to surpass the carrying capacity, that is, the maximum population of a species which a given habitat can indefinitely support, of the entire planet Earth, such that a species-wide crash or die-off is inevitable and imminent. So again, first section in this, section two, first paragraph in section two, the case, population overshoot. He said, let me summarize and comment on what I take to be the most clear-eyed account of humans' precarious position in the world. And editor, audio editor's note, Michael Dowd reading, Connie Barlow, my wife and I both agree that we have found William Catton's book, Overshoot, to be the single most important book we've ever read in our lives. And I've recorded the audio of it that's available if you just Google Grace Limits Audios or Sustainability Audios. You'll get my page. The details are daunting, but the premise is simple. Throughout human evolutionary history, the human population has increased over time as humans have gained access, primarily through migration and technological innovation, to ever greater amounts of resources. Here we can point, as Catton does, to major developments like the use of fire, the invention of spears and other primitive weapons, horticulture, bronze metallurgy, agriculture, iron tools, firearms, industrialization, i.e. fossil-fueled machinery, electrification, and antibiotics. These and other advances, quote-unquote, allowed for the global human population to balloon from an estimated 3 million persons 35,000 years ago to an estimated 7.5 billion persons alive today, an increase of over 250,000%. As quick as this increase is from a geological perspective, it becomes even more striking when we consider that the bulk of human population growth has occurred in just the last 200 years. Since the year 1800, global population has increased from an estimated 969 million to the aforementioned 7.6 billion. This kind of precipitous growth represents another, different meaning of the word eruption, in the sense of a bloom, or the rapid exponential increase of a population after it suddenly gains access to an abundance of the resources it requires. However, Catton's claims do not amount to a mere Neo-Malthusian lament about runaway human population growth. And then he has some parentheses, though Catton, as part of his broader argument, does offer a compelling rehabilitation of Malthus's basic thesis. What matters from an ecological perspective is that the rapid growth of human population from the Industrial Revolution onward has been almost wholly dependent upon the consumption of energy from fossil fuels. Though we in the year 2018 take this fact completely for granted, as Catton explains, quote, "The breakthrough we call industrialism was fundamentally unlike earlier such breakthroughs in human evolutionary history. It did not just take over for human use another portion of the web that had previously supported other forms of life. Instead, it went underground to extract carrying capacity supplements from a finite and depletable fund, a fund that was created and buried by nature scores of millions of years ago before man came along. The drawdown, i.e. extraction, method that we call industrialism relied for its increase of opportunities upon the use of resources that are not renewed in an annual cycle of organic growth. To expect a do it again is to expect to find another exhaustible resource each time we use up a batch. In short, industrial life depends on a perpetual hunt for required substances. Now we rely, as members of industrial societies, upon substances with renewal times that may be thousands or even millions of times longer than a human lifespan. Their renewal is by geological processes. Present stocks of them were put in place by operation of those processes over immeasurably long stretches of Earth's history. Mankind cannot realistically hope to assume management of prehistoric events, or to replenish the ores and fuels now being extracted so ravenously. Instead, we must face the fact that after 10 millennia of progress, Homo sapiens is back at square one. Industrialization committed us to living again, massively, as hunters and gatherers of substances which only nature can provide and which occur only in limited quantity." Unquote. It is this fundamental immutable fact about fossil fuels, i.e. they are finite, that has allowed humans to overshoot the carrying capacity of Earth. For, tragically, we humans have mistaken the energy afforded us by fossil fuels as permanently rather than temporarily available. This error has prevented us from preparing for what is colloquially referred to as peak oil. Even now, over 35 years after the publication of Limits to Growth, and over 10 years after engineering physicist Robert Hirsch's U.S. Department of Energy report warned of the unprecedented risk management problem associated with the impending peaking of world conventional oil production. In Catton's estimation, this species-wide mistake springs from a species-wide source. Indeed, he argues that Homo sapiens, in becoming so utterly dependent on fossil fuels, functionally evolved into a new species, Homo colossus. What most distinguishes Homo colossus from Homo sapiens, as the former name implies, is its expansiveness, whereas Homo sapiens can be thought of in ways similar to its evolutionary forebears, i.e. as a naked ape. Homo colossus redefines the human creature as a man-tool system. This means that Homo colossus is, quote, "a human being equipped with tools or apparatus that greatly enlarge the resource demands and environmental impact of that organism," unquote. In other words, the boundaries of the human organism, regardless of whether or not we consciously realize it, have expanded beyond the skin-encapsulated ego of Homo sapiens to the prosthetic god of Homo colossus. So conceptually speaking, Homo colossus reintegrates into our understanding of the human organism what had previously, and erroneously, been treated as the dismissible externalities of human resource consumption in our industrialized world. I'll say it again. So conceptually speaking, Homo colossus reintegrates into our understanding of the human organism what had previously and erroneously been treated as the dismissible externalities of human resource consumption in our industrialized world. As a result, we can now see how humanity might soon become extinct, just as it nearly became during the Paleolithic era when the global population was reduced by natural disaster to about 1,000 reproductive adults. We can also see, using the Gaia hypothesis or Earth system science, how the activities of a single species can alter the biogeochemistry of the entire planet, just as the lowly cyanobacteria did during the great oxygenation event a few billion years ago. and just as we humans are doing today with carbon dioxide and other fossil fuel emissions. In this fashion, then, and equipped with the concept of Homo Colossus, the consequences of fossil fuel use can be incorporated into an ecological analysis of humanity, tout court. The new, properly ecological perspective on humanity shows us that Homo Colossus is, in fact, a detritivore. A detritivore is, quote, an organism that subsists by consuming detritus, or waste products. Conventional examples of detritivores include algae, fungi, worms, potato bugs, and fiddler crabs. But if we recognize that what Homo Colossus consumes above all else is fossil fuels, for example via foodstuffs that exist and can only exist in adequate quantities through the use of fossil fuel technologies like industrial agriculture and supply chains that require vast fleets of fossil fueled vehicles, etc., then we can clearly see that humans too have become detritivores. Accordingly, industrial human communities are detritivorous insofar as they depend on massive consumption of the transformed organic remains from the Carboniferous period known as fossil fuels. That is, instead of feces, our detritus sources are lumps and puddles of fossilized corpses. These long-dead organisms, when they were living, obtained their own energy either directly or indirectly from photosynthesis. Thus, in consuming fossil fuels, we human colossuses claw beneath the soil, reach back in time, and devour the ancient, unshining sun. Our quasi-speciation into the detritivore Homo Colossus produced one obvious outcome that I have already mentioned above: eruption, or rapid, drastic population growth. But this eruption, like all such eruptions, have now placed us in a precarious position, one with a predictably terminal conclusion. In other words, in forgetting or never truly comprehending that fossil fuels are a finite resource, we humans have grown our population far beyond a level that could be sustained by organic processes alone in the absence of fossil fuels, an absence that will inevitably and shortly come to pass. According to Catton's straightforward calculations, even the 1980 human global population lacking fossil fuels would require for its maintenance, to say nothing of growth, organic renewable resources equivalent to 10 Earths. With a projected human population of 10 billion by the year 2050, assuming that continuation of current growth trends that in fact will not and cannot hold, this disconnect will become even more insurmountably wide. Once we exhaust our supply of detritus, fossil fuels, we will suffer the same fate as all, quote-unquote, of all successful detritivores: crash, or the more or less precipitous decline in numbers that follow when a population has exceeded the carrying capacity of its habitat. This is a common phenomenon in nature, as Catton vividly illustrates in the case of the reindeer population on St. Matthew's Island, or consider the ubiquitous example of algae. Quote, when nutrients from decaying autumn leaves on land are carried by runoff from melting snows into a pond, their consumption by algae in the pond may be checked until springtime by the low winter temperatures that keep the algae from growing. When warm weather arrives, the inflow of nutrients may already be largely complete for the year. The algal population, unable to plan ahead, explodes in the halcyon days of spring in an eruption or bloom that soon exhausts the finite legacy of the sustenance materials. This algal age of exuberance lasts only a few weeks. Long before the seasonal cycle can bring in more detritus, there's a massive die-off of these innocently incautious and exuberant organisms. Unquote. If, through analogical reasoning based on universal ecological principles, we soberly compare the example of an algae population unrestrainedly consuming dead leaves in a pond with the human population unrestrainedly consuming fossil fuels on planet Earth, we must admit that Homo Colossus, like pond scum, is not accepted from the basic principle. Die-off is the sequel to overshoot. Hence, we humans are nearing the end of our necessarily self-terminating way of life. Indeed, our collective species diagnosis is isomorphic with the individual diagnosis of a terminally ill cancer patient. It is not a question of if we will expire, but when? When will the lights go out? In the meantime, we must grieve quickly for ourselves. Elizabeth Kubler Ross, Ross's work on the stages of grief can help, and move with all deliberate speed and by any means necessary toward making arrangements for those few children born posthumously who may remain once we are gone. Now, I can already hear the counter-arguments seeking to deny this basic ecological reality in which humans are embedded. Catton anticipated them, too, and he spends a significant portion of his book prophylactically defeating them. Most notably, Catton dismantles a kind of technocentrism that he calls cargoism, or the faith that technological progress will stave off major institutional change, even in a post-exuberant world. Cargoism as an ideology or a worldview falsely justifies a sort of human exceptionalism from the operation of ecological principles. As such, cargoism is one of the primary terror-relieving mechanisms by which humans convince themselves that they are or can be somehow exempted from the Earth's sixth great extinction event, an event that they have caused and that is presently unfolding all around them. Cargoism, then, covers everything from the seemingly reasonable belief that solar panels and other forms of renewable energy can replace fossil fuels, and then he has in parentheses, they can't, as Morty and Honoré point out, an energy source can be renewable without being ecologically sustainable, to the utter fantasy that terraforming or some other as yet uninvented but surely energy-intensive technology can slow, stop, or even undo the ecological devastation that our fossil-fueled species has wrecked upon the Earth.
That's useful to use the term terraforming.
Yeah.
Exactly. I've only heard that used for Mars. But yeah, once the Earth gets to a certain point, you're trying to terraform it back to something.
So cargoism, so let me go back here. So I can already hear the counter-argument seeking to deny this basic ecological reality in which humans are embedded. Catton anticipated them too, and he spends a significant portion of his book prophylactically deflating them. Most notably, Catton dismantles a kind of technocentrism that he calls cargoism, or the faith that technological progress will stave off major institutional change, even in a post-exuberant world. Cargoism as an ideology or worldview falsely justifies a sort of human exceptionalism from the operation of ecological principles. As such, cargoism is one of the primary terror-relieving mechanisms by which humans convince themselves that they are or can be somehow exempted from this Earth's sixth great extinction event, an event that they have caused and that is presently unfolding all around them. Cargoism, then, covers everything from the seemingly reasonable belief that solar panels and other forms of renewable energy can replace fossil fuels. They can't, as Morty and Honoré point out, quote, an energy source can be renewable without being ecologically sustainable, unquote, to the utter fantasy of terraforming, that's T-E-R-R-A, forming, terraforming, or some other as yet uninvented but surely energy-intensive technology can slow, stop, or even undo the ecological devastation that our fossil-fueled species has wrecked upon the Earth. Such fantasizing underlies, for instance, the puerile varieties of transhumanism, post-humanity, or the singularity, the laughably inadequate Paris Climate Accord, the wasteful and egotistical space adventures of robber baron Elon Musk, and the vapid virtue-signaling histrionics continually performed by the sadistically ignorant elites of the extraction economy at events like last month's World Economic Forum in Davos. For what these fantasies, like all fantasies do above all else, is shield from our conscious awareness the reality of their own fictitiousness. The human penchant for fantasy suggests another major factor for why Overshoot, despite its powerful message, epidemiologist Harold B. Weiss's in 2009 said that William Catton's Overshoot ranks as one of the most important books ever written, period. Why it's not attracted more scholarly interest, to say nothing of mainstream attention or acceptance. Overshoot contains dangerous knowledge. It is a real-life necromucken, I don't know what it is, or Tome of Eternal Darkness. Right, yeah. So, it's a textbook of magic appearing in the horror Lovecraft. So, yeah, it's basically about death and stuff like that. So, I'm going back to the... all right, or Tome of Eternal Darkness. To read it and the related text is to arrive at a crossroads. The path of truth leads to an irrevocable puncturing of the fantasies that underlie human terror management strategies. The path of truth leads to an irrevocable puncturing of the fantasies that underlie human terror management strategies. The path of fantasy, which is the more common choice, ignores or denies truth and leads deeper into delusion. Aldous Huxley understood well this dilemma. Quote, "Suddenly to realize that one is sitting, damned among the other damned, is a most disquieting experience. So disquieting that most of us react to it by immediately plunging more deeply into our particular damnation in the hope, generally realized, that we may be able, at least for a time, to stifle our revolutionary knowledge." Unquote. Insofar as William Catton's revolutionary book itself represents an eruption of extinction awareness, then it, for the same reasons of terror management described above, unsurprisingly has been disregarded by most people, including academics. Let me now make two final notes in this section, for this section. First, we should not mistake Catton's analysis for indictment. As a brute fact, the current human situation cannot be pinned on any one person or group of people. And, much to my dismay, Overshoot cannot be wholly blamed on capitalism either. Indeed, although growth for the sake of growth is both capitalism's prime directive as well as the ideology of a cancer cell, any non-ecological system of social organization, including non-ecological socialism, communism, or anarchism, would almost certainly have led to the same outcome of population overshoot, albeit perhaps not quite as quickly. After all, Julian Jaynes reminds us, quote, "Language is an organ of perception, not simply a means of communication." Language is an organ of perception, not simply a means of communication. So, since the very word ecology did not even emerge until the late 19th century and did not become popularized until the 1960s, most humans literally could not have seen the sword of Damocles that they were collectively positioning their progeny beneath. Thus, we should concur with Catton that overshoot is humanity's fate, quote-unquote. For as sociologist C. Wright Mills explains, fate is shaping human history when what happens to us was intended by no one and was the summary outcome of innumerable small decisions about other matters by innumerable people. This notion of fate as a failure of coordination provides one explanation for why, as Joseph Tainter shows in The Collapse of Complex Societies, civilizations throughout history have regularly fallen. Indeed, when we recognize that even now, in the age of the internet, humans are beset by seemingly intractable collective action problems, we have to admit that our history, as it actually unfolded, never afforded us an opportunity to avert our upcoming rendezvous with destiny. Indeed, when we So this notion, C. Wright Mills' notion of fate, as a failure of coordination, provides one explanation for why, as Joseph Tainter shows in The Collapse of Complex Societies, civilizations throughout history have regularly fallen. Indeed, when we recognize that even now, in the age of the internet, humans are beset by seemingly intractable collective action problems, we have to admit that our history, as it is actually unfolded, never afforded us an opportunity to avert our upcoming rendezvous with destiny. Hence, we must forgive ourselves, for we knew not what we did. Truly, human population overshoot, stemming from fossil fuel exuberance, may well represent our species' encounter with the Fermi paradox and the hypothesized great filter that accompanies it. The Fermi's paradox, writes philosopher Nick Bostrom, director of the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford University, refers to the question mark that hovers over the data point that we have seen no signs of extraterrestrial life. In other words, given the vastness of the universe and the high probability that many Earth-like planets, some significantly older than our own Earth, circles the billions of sun-like stars scattered throughout the universe, why have we not met or been met by extraterrestrial organisms? In Enrico Fermi's words, where is everybody? The most widely accepted answer to Fermi's question is that all forms of intelligent extraterrestrial life have been destroyed or have destroyed themselves prior to the point at which they might have been able to contact us, or, conversely, that we might have been able to detect them. The implication, then, is that there must be at least one great filter, an evolutionary leap, that is extremely improbable somewhere on the line between Earth-like planets and colonizing in detectable ways civilization. Now, there are reasons to believe that humans have already passed the great filter. We have come a long, dangerous way from our unicellular forebears, but we cannot know for sure. Thus, if the great filter isn't in humanity's past, we must fear that it might be in the near future. Indeed, risk analyst Jason Matheny, director of the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Activity Group within the U.S. Office of the Director of National Intelligence, suggests that humanity could be extinguished as soon as this century by succumbing to near-term extinction risks. These risks include, among other things, nuclear detonations or volcanic eruptions that could generate enough atmospheric debris to terminate food production, and greenhouse gas emissions that could trigger a positive feedback loop, causing a radical change in climate. And then he has a chart here, figure six, is quantitative categories of risk. Global catastrophic risks are in the upper right of the diagram, existential risks for an especially severe subset of these. I'm not going to try to describe this, but it's here. Matheny's concerns about the probability of multiple overlapping extinction factors brings me to the second note. That is, we should keep in mind that what I have described earlier in summarizing William Catton's work touches only on what we might call the thermodynamic reality of our predicament vis-a-vis fossil fuels. This means that though I have gestured toward them, I have not fully incorporated into my present case for near-term human extinction other interrelated or contemporaneous global catastrophic risks, existential risks, or converging catastrophes. One person who has made such an attempt to integrate these many threats is cosmologist and astrophysicist Martin Rees, co-founder of the Center for the Study of Existential Risk at the University of Cambridge. Rees's conclusion in his 2003 book, Our Final Hour, is that, quote, the odds are no better than 50-50 that our present civilization on Earth will survive to the end of the 21st century, unquote. Rees's grim prognosis has been echoed more recently by scholars as diverse as linguist Noam Chomsky, cloud dynamics specialist Peter Turchin, and futures and peace study pioneer Johann Galtung, the latter of whom accurately predicted the collapse of the Soviet Union and, 18 years ago, predicted the fall of the U.S. Empire by the year 2020. Though I lack the space and time here to make as comprehensive a case as Rees and the others, before moving on, I would like to briefly mention what I see as the most significant risks attending our population overshoot. So again, before moving on, I'd like to briefly mention what I see as the most significant risks attending our population overshoot. These risks include, one, accelerating anthropogenic climate breakdown, itself in all its variegated forms a function of fossil fuel consumption. Two, the staggering loss of global biodiversity, reflective of our position in the Holocene extinction. Three, the rise of what political theorist Sheldon Wolin calls inverted totalitarianism, or increasingly inequitable, extractionistic, and repressive corporatratic neoliberal or neo-fascist regimes, which, as the folks in Rojavia have shown, can perhaps be resisted best through principles of social ecology and practices of libertarian municipalism. And of course, 4, nuclear weapons of the kind that so terrorized the minds of the Hawaiians on January 13th, and about which Donald Trump, a quote, dangerous, mentally unstable, sociopath, abusive, pathological narcissist, according to 27 leading psychiatrists and mental health experts exercising their civic duty to warn in the dangerous case in their book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, wonders if the United States has them, why can't we use them? It is to the reminders of these terrors, intrusions into consciousness of extinction awareness, or eruptions of eruption, that I now wish to return. Section 3, some philosophical implications of the case of Overshoot. If we accept that the case, as I have just briefly presented it, and it's worth noting that Catton's argument was convincing enough to persuade Stuart Udall, former U.S. congressman from Arizona and Secretary of the Interior under Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, to pen Overshoot's foreword, and editors note that foreword by Stuart Udall to Catton's book is a fabulous document in itself, then my argument from this premise is as follows. What persons are perceiving, however vaguely or precognitively, when they experience eruptions of extinction awareness, is precisely the unfolding crash stemming from human population overshoot. In other words, these persons are suddenly, horrifyingly, and ineffably experiencing themselves in relation to the hyperobject to end all hyperobjects, extinction. Thus, they are peering behind the veil of our reality, glimpsing the terrifying vistas of reality alluded to by Lovecraft, and feeling their own frightful position therein. And like dogs barking before an earthquake, these persons understandably panic in the face of this incomprehensible and ineluctable doom. After all, panic happens when the confidence of society's members in each other breaks down and gives way to an every-man-for-himself type of scrambling. This can arise from 1, general perception of severe and immediate danger, coupled with 2, belief that the opportunities for escape are limited, 3, belief that these opportunities are diminishing, and 4, an absence of adequate communication about the danger. These conditions well match those that arise during events that produce eruptions of extinction awareness. Therefore, as we approach extinction, these conditions, which call to mind Hobbes's bellum omnium contra omnes, or Thucydides' disturbing account of plague-ridden Athens, will eventually, in a vast cacophonous crescendo, engulf every human community on Earth. Thus, as philosopher Peter Wessel Zephy contends, existential dread will become the universal tragedy of our species' overdeveloped consciousness, and first to be struck by this malady will be those of us who hear and see too much for sanity, unquote. Indeed, it is not unreasonable to expect that, once it is seen by every person that the entirety of planet Earth is in the same existentially vulnerable position as Hawaii has been in during those 38 minutes, pandemonium, unlike any experienced in human history, will reign. For in Black Mirror-like fashion, the internet and smartphone-powered piecing together of dissociated knowledge could very well weave for us a fluctuating but mutually constitutive and undeniable tapestry of terror. As Nietzsche says, quote, "The more eyes, different eyes, we can use to observe one thing, the more complete will be our concept of this thing. In this case, the more complete will be our concept of ecocide." Thus, humanity will belatedly and in unison realize with Manhattan Project physicist Robert Oppenheimer that together we colossuses have become death, the destroyer of worlds. So then, paraphrasing Albert Camus, there is but one truly serious philosophical problem, and that is extinction. But what do we do about it? One possibility is to work backwards from our conclusion about extinction's inevitability to reinterpret it in that light the events of today. This might seem to suggest, as paleontologist Michael Novak puts it, quote, that the overarching recognition that we live in a world already radically transformed by human activity must frame our strategies for effecting maintenance or recovery of our vital ecosystems. Unquote. But though I agree with Novak that the current biodiversity crisis has one obvious biotic cause, ourselves, I do not share even his tepid optimism that, quote, the source of the trauma also has to be presumed, has the presumed capacity to mitigate it, to mitigate its own deleterious impact, unquote. To be blunt, it seems to me that such mitigation would require us to make unprecedented changes on an infeasible scale within an impossible time frame. Can't we find some humility here at the end? My pessimism about mitigation notwithstanding, if any members of our species are to have any hope of surviving our self-inflicted extinction event, we must indeed resolve our ongoing failure to recognize that we are in it. We should then devote all of our efforts to facilitating what psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton calls the climate swerve, or our evolving awareness of our predicament. To that end, I propose, following Catton, that we can gain a far more adequate understanding of our world if we shift, in the manner described most famously by Thomas Kuhn, and more recently in the spirit of inquiry similar to my own by Grant Maxwell, from a pre-ecological paradigm to an ecological paradigm. In so doing, we can come to see how historical and current events, like Trump's election, quote-unquote, and swift normalization, the water crisis nearing day zero in Cape Town, the American opioid epidemic, the famine genocide in Yemen, and the abrupt loss of Arctic sea ice, can be read with foresight as the kinds of omens or signs mentioned above. But not only can an ecological paradigm help us demystify much of the suffering that has accompanied our pre-ecological ignorance, it can also, more significantly for our future, empower us to take the steps that we must take in order for some small number of us to perhaps survive our current predicament. For as Plotinus, P-L-O-T-I-N-U-S, Plotinus writes, quote, the knowledge of future things is, in a word, identical with that of the present, unquote. Thus, there is a profound peril in the continued flagrant misperception of the very nature of the human situation in what we now call the Anthropocene. Indeed, the perils of 7.5 billion Wile E. coyotes looking down all at once, yikes! To be sure, misperception is the problem to be overcome by a paradigm shift, and only a paradigm shift can overcome it, according to Catton. Yet, affecting this paradigm shift is a task of appropriately colossal proportions. How, if at all, can we hope to educate others for this kind of transformation of consciousness? How can one teach an unspeakable truth to those who lack the ears to hear it? Editor's note, Michael Dowd speaking, I don't think it can happen without religion, and religion needs to have a born-again experience before it can happen. It needs to be born again in an ecological sense. That's what I'm trying to do. Who knows whether I'll be effective. Put differently, how do we overcome the quandary of Nietzsche's madman, who, after speaking plainly his truth, sees that he has not been comprehended? Quote, I have come too early, he said to them. My time is not yet. This tremendous event is still on its way, still wandering. It has not yet reached the ears of men. Lightning and thunder require time. The light of the stars requires time. Deeds, though done, still require time to be seen and heard. This deed is still more distant from them than the most distant stars, and yet they have done it themselves. Unquote. It seems that the madman's only option is to find a way to reduce the distance between the ears of men and the deed. This, then, is the task to which I can and must now bring my entire being to bear. Not because I think I can or will succeed. Surely my efforts will amount to little more than polishing the brass on the Titanic. But I do this because, knowing what I know and being who I am, I feel obligated or compelled to try. I hope that you, reader, having come to understand the human situation for what it is, now feel similarly. For we are going to need each other's help as night closes in. And that phrase, as night closes in, is hot linked to John Michael Greer's summary overview of William Catton and the announcement of his death after I called him and let him know that Catton had died. Section 4, Conclusion. Before concluding, let me say that if you've made it this far, I applaud and thank you. It takes courage to confront this truth and perseverance to endure my unsparing writing style. Second, and since what's past is prologue, quote-unquote, I want to briefly describe my preliminary approach to closing the gap between ears and deed. The problem of misperception about the human situation is an epistemological one. This epistemological conundrum, as I see it, has three major dimensions. One, cognitive. Two, ideological, or worldview-based. And three, existential. More verbosely, the most significant obstacles blocking from human awareness the reality of impending extinction stem from one, cognitive limitations, e.g., common cognitive biases such as time preference and the inability of most persons, primarily resulting from their having been miseducated, not from innate intellectual deficiencies, to think in the mode of what Jean-Paul Piaget calls formal operational thinking, to say nothing of the more advanced and far less widespread modes of dialogical thinking, vision logic, and systems thinking, among others. Two, conceptual blind spots stemming from various systemic ideological misconstruals of reality, e.g. false consciousness or misrecognition of one's place in hierarchical and classist society, capitalist dogma like the unquestioned and unquestionable value of unlimited growth, which makes degrowth unimaginable and therefore impossible, and Catton's cargoism. Three, inability or unwillingness to ask existential questions and to confront one's own mortality even under optimal conditions, i.e. death denial as described by terror management theory, and therefore an almost unbreakable attachment to the illusory pseudo-subject of the individuated ego. Taken together, these impediments prevent our moving from a pre-ecological to an ecological paradigm. To overcome them, we must do so deliberately and compassionately, what eruptions of extinction awareness do violently and indiscriminately. Also, again, taken together, these impediments prevent our moving from a pre-ecological to an ecological paradigm. To overcome them, we must do deliberately and compassionately what eruptions of extinction awareness do violently and indiscriminately. That is, we must systematically deconstruct our paradigmatic limitations in a way that, from their rubble, offers reconstructive resources for the developmental move from a less to more adequate species-wide paradigm or worldview. Then, with the eyesight nearer to Ramana Maharishi's or Krishnamurti's, we will be able to see that, quote, it is no measure of health to be well-adjusted to a profoundly sick society, unquote. In a sense, this amounts to an idea of education as simulated near-death experience. Fitting, given our proximity to extinction. This framing emphasizes the fact that rather than focusing our efforts on trying to change the scene, we must instead attempt to alter the seer. For the goal is not to persuade humans that things are different than they think they are. Rather, the goal is to empower humans to disclose to themselves a state of affairs that is already the case, but that is going misperceived by them. Therefore, as adult educator scholar Jack Mesrow's work demonstrates, we must change humans' perspectives on their world, a process which necessarily entails changing their conceptions of themselves. What I'm suggesting, in other words, is that there is a mode of being that is as qualitatively distinct from conventional adulthood as conventional adulthood is from childhood, and that this more advanced level of development is what we should be trying to realize in ourselves as a strategy for surviving extinction. And then he has figure 8, Catton's typology of modes of adaptation to ecologically inexorable change. These types, especially types 2, 1, 2, and 5, amount to distinct and incompatible epistemological perspectives or worldviews, that is, cults that snuff each other out, in Piaget's words, and thus are ripe for integration through transcendence, that is, sublation, to a more adequate paradigm. And what he has is the names realism, cargoism, cosmeticism, cynicism, and ostracism from Catton's Overshoot. Ironically, then, the only way for us to save ourselves from extinction is to die to what we are and to become reborn as something we are not. An important part of this process will be the heeding of Zafri's call for antinatalism. Know yourselves, be infertile, and let the earth be silent after ye. Tragically, not all will hear this injunction, and so we must consider the plight of the children who will continue to be born even as our species draws nearer and nearer to extinction. These youths, who will not be burdened by any obligations to a dysgenic, filicidal system of social organization that has doomed and declared war on them from before the moment of their conception, who, having been thrown into this world, will not hesitate to acknowledge the self-evident reality of the human situation that their indoctrinated elders, embedded in the gerontocracy self-serving deny, will likely be our species' only hope for survival. Educating this final fated generation for undergoing, and perhaps overcoming, extinction, then, is the labor with which wise adults will soon be, or already are, tasked. I have much more to say about how we might organize to systematically perform this labor, recognizing, of course, that in reality there's not enough time left for us to actually complete it, as well as about what my own contribution to this labor might take. However, this essay is not the place to go further into detail on these points. That is what my future research, including my dissertation, is for. Until then, I will say that my fool's hope lies in the kind of work being done by scholars focused on the nexus of developmental psychology, deliberative democracy, critical pedagogy, and psychagogy, and cosmopolitanism. In particular, political theorist Jack Crittenden's book, Wide as the World, Cosmopolitan Identity, Integral Politics, and Democratic Dialogue. Futurist Jennifer Gidley's book, Post-Formal Education, A Philosophy for Complex Futures. Integral theorist Ken Wilber's O-U-V-R-E. What's that?
That's his body of work.
Okay. And much of the thinking being done in certain academic journals like the World Futures, the Journal of the New Paradigm Research, and Journal of Transformative Education stand out as the most compelling sources of inspiration for promoting radical species-wide change. In the meantime, what matters is that all of us come to grips with the human situation. Crucially, each of us can do this on his or her own. We do not need to wait for utopian institutional change to guide us. To that end, take seriously the merit of philosophical spirituality. For as physicist Fritjof Capra points out, quote, ecology and spirituality are fundamentally connected because deep ecological awareness, ultimately, is spiritual awareness. In pursuit of that awareness, consider especially traditions such as Buddhism, Advaita Vedantism, Stoicism, Transcendentalism, and Existentialism that prescribe specific practices like meditation, contemplation, introspection, physical training, or ritualistic psychedelic use, such as ayahuasca. All of these and more can help one to, quote, collapse now and avoid the rush, as former Grand Archdruid John Michael Greer puts it. Indeed, these spiritual approaches can empower an individual to overcome his or her fear of death by dissociating or deconstructing the illusion which the literal and symbolic immortality projects conducted under the guise of terror management futilely seek to preserve, namely the ego. With the walls of the ego thus taken down, or revealed to have been always been hallucinatory, the currents of the universal being, quote-unquote, can circulate into the transparent eyeball, expanding thereby perception of the spectrum of consciousness and disclosing new world spaces, ecological world spaces, as a result. This is not unlike what Albert Einstein, working from his belief that the concept I is an illusion produced by our self-creating language, means when he says that the problems facing us cannot be solved at the same level of thinking that created them. These spiritual paths, then, represent the best accumulated wisdom pertaining to the enduring human quest toward embracing mortality and realizing non-dual being. Indeed, striving to reach this way of being, through something like the overview effect, Ken Wilber's notion of the world-centric level of development, or what philosopher of education David Hanson calls a cosmopolitan orientation, is the exact shift in perspective that we humans must make if we are to understand and perhaps survive our current situation on, quote-unquote, spaceship Earth. For every crisis supplies a turning point between tragedy and serendipity. So although we cannot avert the calamities to come, we must not despair. Instead, we must overcome ourselves. Like Nietzsche's Zarathustra, we must recognize that it is high time to embrace death in life. After all, with life as short as a half-taken breath, Rumi seems to ask, why wait? Rather, with Marcus Aurelius, we should consider ourselves to be dead and to have completed our lives up to the present time. Thus, we, like Tolkien's Gandalf, can see that all we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given us. For as Frank Ocean asks, we are all mortals, aren't we? Any moment this could go. Yes, Plato's Socrates tells us that philosophy is nothing other than preparation for dying and death. So William James is right. No matter how sweet life's party, still, the skull will grin in at the banquet. And like Tyler Durden, we ought to meet that greeting with a shit-eating grin of our own. Similarly, Camus advises, come to terms with death. Therefore, thereafter, anything is possible. This frees us, while Ralph Waldo Emerson agrees, to live with nature in the present above time. Indeed, Montaigne says, to practice death is to practice freedom. He who has learned how to die has unlearned how to be a slave. Only then, according to Krishnamurti, can we know that extraordinary state of being nothing, of coming to the abyss of an eternal movement, as it were, and dropping over the edge. So gaze long into that abyss, my friends, and drop off. Light a lantern as you fall through a terrasect beyond the veil of our reality, and once you cross Owl Creek in the mountains of madness, find a human with whom to share an amontillado. I don't know what that is. In other words, do as Jesus said and leave the dead to bury their own dead. For Ken Wilber assures us the void that you are looking for is identical to the void that you don't see when you look within for the looker. So that the sought is the seeker is the sought, always already suffering death now. We are already always living eternally. The search is already always over. Complete this unbeginnable quest, conquering death. Completing this unbeginnable quest, conquering death, is the only way to brace ourselves for the mass eruptions of extinction awareness that await on the horizon. For it is only by overcoming the terror of death that we can achieve true equanimity. This is what Nietzsche calls amour fati, or what an incandescent French woman, whom I'm lucky to know, embodies as joie de vivre. Yeah, that. Unfortunately, those qualities are rare. Historically, such equanimity has been quite difficult for humans who fear their own death to actualize. But at this point, we no longer have a choice. We must all become like the swans, who, when they realize they must die, sing most and most beautifully. We must all philosophize as preparation for death in the age of extinction. The first step in doing so demands that each of us stop denying or ignoring the truth about his or her place in the human situation. Rather, to paraphrase Jeffrey Rush's wonderfully deserved reality-warping admonishment at the end of The Pirates of Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl, quote, we best start believing in human extinction. We're living through it. Appendix 1. suggested websites. Reddit Collapse. This is by far the largest informal online community for extinction-aware folks, a.k.a. collapsniks. The forum is not without problems, as in many fringe communities, sensationalized headlines, unfounded conspiracy theories, and bigotry slip in, though these problems tend to be dealt with quickly by moderators. But to my knowledge, Reddit Collapse offers the Internet's most well-curated collection of collapse-related news stories and commentary, including excellent insights from some anonymous community members. The Archdruid Report, Mirror. This is a mirror of John Michael Greer's former blog. Greer served from 2003 to 2015 as the Grand Archdruid of the Ancient Order of Druids in America. I have set the link to Greer's entry titled Collapse Now and Avoid the Rush, which I think is perhaps the most compelling starting and ending point for his writing. The Center for the Study of Existential Risk, CSER, is an interdisciplinary research center within the Center of Research, the Arts, Social Sciences, and Humanities at the University of Cambridge, dedicated to the study and mitigation of existential risk. Collapse of Industrial Civilization. I have not spent much time browsing this blog, from my initial inspection, it seems to be quite a decent source of relevant information and commentary. Ecosophia, John Michael Greer's current blog. Global Catastrophic Risk Institute, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank founded in 2011 by Seth Baum and Tony Barrett. It studies a full range of global catastrophic risks in order to answer the big questions. Which risks should society be most worried about? How do the different risks affect each other? And above all, what are the best ways to reduce the risk? The Future of Humanity Institute. FHI is a multidisciplinary research institute at the University of Oxford. Scholars at the Institute bring the tools of mathematics, philosophy, social sciences, and science to bear on big-picture questions about humanity and its prospects. It's led by founding director, Professor Nick Bostrom. The Future of Life Institute. FLI's mission is to catalyze and support research and initiatives for safeguarding life and developing optimistic visions of the future, including positive ways for humanity to steer its own course, considering new technologies and challenges. Helical Holdings, founded by Dylan Ratigan. Helical Holdings designs and manufactures sustainable, state-of-the-art, plug-and-play food, water, electricity, and communication systems intended to convert global goodwill to reduce poverty and improve health into distributed resource security, jobs, and education for every community in America and every country in the world, quote-unquote. Wow. Nature Bats Last is the website of Guy McPherson, Professor Emeritus of Natural Resources and Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Arizona. McPherson predicts near-term human extinction will result primarily from abrupt climate change. Some of his claims are questionable, but nevertheless, his work is some of the best on this topic. See, for example, his discussion of positive feedback loops and the phenomenon of global dimming. The Next System Project. The Next System Project is an initiative of the Democracy Collaborative aimed at bold thinking and action to address the systemic challenges the United States faces now and in the coming decades. Deep crises of economic inequality, racial injustice, and climate change, to name but three, are upon us, and systemic problems require systemic solutions. Working with a broad group of researchers, theorists, and activists, we are using the best research, understanding, and strategic thinking on the one hand and on-the-ground organizing and developmental experience on the other to promote visions, models, and pathways that point to a next system, radically different in fundamental ways from the failed systems of the past and the present and capable of delivering superior social, economic, and especially ecological outcomes. Paul Beckwith, climate system scientist. This is the personal website of Paul Beckwith, currently a PhD student at the University of Ottawa. Beckwith's research focuses on abrupt climate change from an Earth system science perspective. Resilience. This website's purpose is, quote, to support building community resilience in a world of multiple emerging challenges, the decline of cheap energy, the depletion of critical resources like water, complex environmental crises like climate change and biodiversity loss, and the social and economic issues which are linked to these, unquote. As such, Resilience serves as an information clearinghouse and network of action-oriented groups focused on building community resilience. And the World Futures Studies Federation, the WFSF, is a, quote, nonprofit global NGO, transdisciplinary group of scholars, teachers, researchers, foresight practitioners, policy analysts, activists, students, and others with a long-range view. WFSF is dedicated to stimulating awareness of the urgent need for long-term thinking in government, policy, civil, and educational institutions to resolve complex local, national, regional, and global problems. Check out especially their list of books and journals. And then Appendix 2 is selected unreferenced readings, and he has a list of books, and I'm not going to bother reading all of these right now, but I will say that this essay, again, is written by, let me scroll down to the bottom here, it's heavily footnoted, it's written by Rory, R-O-R-Y, Varato, V-A-R-R-A-T-O. He's a PhD student in the Philosophy and Education program at Teachers College, Columbia University, and you can find him on Facebook and Twitter, both. And again, this essay was titled, We Are the Threat, Reflections on Near-Term Human Extinction, February 14th, 2018, by Rory Varato, published on the Critical Theory Research Network. Read by Michael Dowd.